Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And here's a question for all of us. What are zoos for? They've always been considered an essential tool to teach people about the wild kingdom by bringing those animals up close. Well, you could make the case today that we now have the Discovery Channel, and we have those amazingly interactive websites, and we have transportation systems that will take us whale watching or on safari or out to the field, so maybe it's better to let the birds and animals be. Increasingly, those zoos have become a lot more than just rows of cages. They are a place for science and the study of animal behavior. They are a lot more friendly than they used to be. But along comes a new study which says that some animals just shouldn't be locked up, that the polar bear, for example, is a mammal born to range hundreds of miles lumbering across the Arctic ice, and that it can't survive properly in a large concrete tub with bars. But at the same time, zoologists say zoos need to be considered a key place to guard and protect and rebuild endangered species. So, Connection listeners, what's your view? We all have our own zoo stories, memorable moments with the animals, but could our children or our grandchildren live without zoos? At a time when so many kids appear more interested in killing time at the mall, is it still important to make sure that there's zoos there for them? Does it make any sense to say, on the contrary, just leave the animals alone, let them be in the wild? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us for this conversation from the NPR studio in Washington is Michael Hutchins. He has worked professionally in zoos and wildlife conservation field for nearly 30 years. He's currently director of conservation and science for the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. Michael, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
And Rory Brown is here with me in Boston. He is a zoo historian at Harvard University. He also co-chairs the Education Committee for Zoo New England. Rory, nice to have you with us.
Hello, Jake.
Can we start then with, without going through the details of this study from Oxford University, Rory, there are a couple of scientists saying that the lions and tigers and polar bears, the carnivores, need more room to move and perhaps they shouldn't be locked up. Is it time, once again, to ask if the zoo, the moment of the zoo, has passed?
Well, I think with that study, you first of all have to be aware that they're not talking about all carnivores and not all animals, obviously. And they are actually recommending, perhaps, that zoos concentrate on certain types of animals that they think do better in zoos. The other thing to say is, of course, that many of their findings are disputed. They haven't listed all the animals which they're including in their recommendations. And they also, of course, haven't necessarily compared, you know, in a scientific survey, a control animal, how an animal does better in one type of cage than another. And then that, of course, raises the whole question of the cage. I think modern zoos would defend themselves by saying that what they're trying to do is turn the cage into a territory. From being a method of confining animals, what they see now is the cage as a method of supplying the animal with all its wants, so that the animal can, in a sense, replicate in captivity its activities in nature.
All right, so we'll take that as a no. It's not time to rule on the end of the zoo. Michael, what's your opinion here? Do you think that that it's reasonable to question whether or not we need zoos today?
Well, I think that any organization or institution needs to continually question the justifications for its existence. Otherwise, how can it possibly get better at what it does? That being said, you know, I've worked in the wildlife conservation field for many years, and I do believe that zoos and aquariums are going to be critical for the future of wildlife, primarily because most of the public now are living in urban areas. They're completely divorced from nature. And the zoo or aquarium, the professionally managed one, is one of the few places left where they can come to develop these connections. And, of course, zoos and aquariums need to constantly ask questions of themselves whether or not they're providing the best possible care for the animals based on current knowledge. If you were to ask the question whether or not gorillas should be in captivity around the turn of the century, I think our answer would have been no, because they didn't live very long. Mm-hmm. Now they live long lives, they reproduce regularly, they behave normally, and it's because we've used our knowledge to better manage these animals in captivity.
But I mean, we will still open our newspapers, Rory, and read stories about angry male gorillas that want to get out of zoos and tigers that are being used as part of circus acts that are attacking their keepers. And
Well, I would distinguish. I think you're talking about actually two different things. I think you're assuming that the gorilla was angry and wanted to get out of the zoo rather than that he was an adolescent gorilla, as it were, feeling his oats. I think this was a gorilla who was interested in exploring and is very interested in people, actually. So that, I think, is probably the story behind
Little
Joe.
What I meant was it raises the question whether or not we've figured out how to do it properly yet.
Well, I think that zoos as institutions, as Mike was saying, continually reinventing themselves according to the best knowledge that they have available. You know, I mean, if you look at zoos, say, 30 years back, when you had largely the bathroom style of zoo architecture, when zoos were consisted, good zoos I'm talking about now, you know, mainstream zoos consisted of tiled concrete boxes with plate glass fronts so that people could see the animals. The animals were on stage perpetually. The animals were constantly seen, and they were kept in the most hygienic conditions imaginable, conditions that could easily be sluiced down and disinfected. And actually, these zoos, of course, had very good longevity and sometimes even good breeding records. But we wouldn't want to keep a gorilla or a tiger or any other animal like that in a decent and responsible zoo. And to answer your question about the tigers, I would draw a very firm distinction between accredited zoos, accredited by the organization for which Mike works, mm-hmm. and between roadside attractions and private collections. I think there's a sort of human hunger to keep animals, and almost a pathological hunger to keep exotic and dangerous animals. You've only got to look at the number of people who sort of stroll down the street with an iguana on their head or a boa constrictor wrapped around their arm to see that there is this sort of human desire to shock and to outrage and to demonstrate their own, I suppose it's their own prowess in keeping these beasts. But I would distinguish that from a zoo that is properly accredited and run with, we hope, educational, scientific, and lines.
Well, Michael, let me ask you about the accreditation there. It's a good point that Rory brings up, because if I read the numbers correctly, the American Zoo Association has accredited something like 200 zoos of the 26, 27, 2800 that exist. That's not encouraging news.
Well, as Roy said, we have to draw a distinction between good zoos and bad zoos, and zoo professionals today understand the difference between those two types of organizations. The accreditation process that AZA has developed is a very difficult peer review process, which is very hard to get through. And very few institutions can do it. And as Rory mentioned, it's only about 8% in the United States of licensed animal exhibitors. And these are exhibitors that are licensed by USDA APHIS mm-hmm. To show animals to the public. But only about 8% of them meet AZA's stringent accreditation standards.
But what does it say about the other 92% if they can't achieve that accreditation?
Well, in fact, AZA members are very concerned about this, because often accredited zoos get painted with the same brush as ones that are not managing animals up to the standards that we manage them and are not constantly trying to reinvent themselves based on new information. So, yes, that is a tremendous concern.
Let's go back a little bit, if we can, Rory, into history. There was a time when exotic animals were the playthings of princes and kings, but there was also a time when that changed and they became accessible to ordinary people. How far back do we go for that?
Well, you can go right back if you want to. I mean, you can go back into the Middle Ages and the founding of the Tower Menagerie. And the kings of England kept big cats in the tower as a demonstration of their own power and prowess and as symbols of their own majesty, right from the time of Henry III and the time of Magna Carta onwards. And the Tower Menagerie, by the end of the time, the kings had moved out. Kings didn't want to stay in the nasty, drafty tower. But the tower remained and became, in a sense, a public exhibition place. By the 18th century, you're getting all sorts of increasing numbers of animals being imported from the sort of nascent European empires. And so you're getting commercial menageries now. There was one very well-known menagerie, Exeter Change, which was actually in two rooms above a shopping arcade in what is now the sort of Charing Cross area of London. And people always ask me, well, how did they get the elephant up? They actually made the elephant walk upstairs by putting planks across. So they had an elephant in this room. They had kangaroos loose. They had to be a bit careful because the kangaroos had a habit of jumping into
lions' den. Was this what entrepreneurs who wanted to make some money?
Yeah, these were people who would buy animals that were being brought back by sailors on ships returning from India that had touched in at Africa or South America. These entrepreneurs would buy the animals, they'd show them off, they'd advertise the feeding times, they'd have a beef eater there advertising the feeding time, ringing a bell. But they'd also sell the animals to gentry who'd want them in their gardens and parks. And then they'd take the animals, they'd trundle them round in sort of, you know, a fair-like or circus wagon-like buildings around Britain and stop at inns and market squares or go out to private homes.
But something happened, and you'll have to tell me how long ago, when zoos became a mark of an educated city, a mark of
well,
civic pride.
Yes, I mean, that really happens with the sort of the late 18th, early 19th century. That's when in Paris you get the founding of the Jardin des Plantes, which is, I know, means botanic garden, but that's actually where the first public scientific menagerie open to the public in a major city was founded during the French Revolution. And then, of course, the English, after they'd defeated the French in the Napoleonic Wars and had acquired, you know, a vast empire in India, they thought they should have an institution like that. And that's when the London Zoo is founded. And that's when you really get the sort of the term zoological gardens coming from, because it was the menagerie of the menagerie in the gardens of the zoological society. And that becomes a fashionable place for the middle classes to walk. It also becomes a place where when the animals die, they're dissected and described. And then later, of course, with the sort of economic pressures, it's open to the general public, and it becomes the place where the working classes go on holidays and, you know, they see the first hippopotamus brought to Europe since the days of the Romans, Obeish, this vast, his rolling hulk, as he was called.
And Michael Hutchins, I just wonder whether or not we're still on that continuum of figuring out what the zoos ought to be, or are they sort of adapting day to day or year to year to changing circumstances?
Well, I think zoos and aquariums, professionally managed ones, accredited ones, are working together to redefine themselves. And I think they need to reinvent themselves. As times change, organizations have to change. And I think that, you know, it's very clear that they are focusing themselves now on the, you know, very important societal issues of conservation and associated educational and scientific endeavors, which are going to be very important in the future to try to preserve at least some semblance of animals and wildlife and nature in a very human-dominated world.
And that means even if I were to go and take my daughter to see the cheetah and the cheetah happens to be hiding inside the hollow log, tough luck now. I don't get the sort of bathroom view that Rory was describing.
Well, and that is very difficult for zoos and aquariums. I think we have to make more of an effort to educate the public about the needs of animals and why we do certain things that we do. And you're right, it may be more difficult to see an animal in a highly naturalistic setting where they can hide behind trees, but it is much better for the animals. And if you're patient and you can wait a little while, you will see them, and you will see them behaving much more natural than you would in a small, sterile exhibit.
Connection listeners, Michael Hutchins and Rory Brown say that zoos have to reinvent themselves. Well, what's their place in society today? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program this hour, Rory Brown, zoo historian at Harvard, serves on the advisory council and co-chairs the education committee for Zoo New England. Michael Hutchins with us from a studio in Washington. He's director of conservation and science for the American Zoo and Aquarium Association, also known as the AZA, based out of Silver Spring, Maryland. And our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Carrboro, North Carolina. We'll take our first call from Jimmy. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm wondering, with the so-called progress of humanity around the world destroying habitats left and right.
Sounding a little cynical there, Jimmy.
It's hard not to be. I just wonder if our resources can't be better spent trying to preserve the actual habitats that these animals live in as opposed to trying to recreate them somewhere else. I mean, I don't know how many millions of dollars in human resources are spent, you know, maintaining zoos, and if they can't be better spent preserving the natural habitat of the animal itself.
I may actually have a guest I've not yet introduced who would be best at answering that. His name's Richard Wrangham. He's been here on the program before. Richard's a professor of anthropology at Harvard University. And Richard, correct me, but it's like a month or two of every year you're in Kibale National Park in western Uganda. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
Studying chimpanzees. And you've been doing that for some 16 years. So what about Jimmy's question? Would the money be better invested in the field, in the natural habitat?
Well, I mean, of course it's right that there is a tension between the desire to protect the habitats and to create a constituency of interest by displaying the species to the general public. In Uganda, it's quite clear that these things work together, because one of the great problems of the destruction of habitat is the creation of orphans, of animals that have got nowhere to live. And it's a tremendous irony when you think about the way zoos are changing, that on the one hand, in this country, you can't possibly go out and catch any more apes to show. I mean, people wouldn't stand for it. And so there is no recruitment of apes into the population, and people don't want to see more coming in. And yet in Africa and in the range countries, you have a tremendous overpopulation of orphaned animals that people find it very difficult to deal with.
So are you saying, in answer to Jimmy, that you have to have both, that it's not just a matter of putting all the resources towards the natural habitat then?
You absolutely have to have both in the range countries. And what I'm saying is that in the range countries, they can't handle the problem of the number of captive individuals that they're faced with. And it would be great to have a system for being able to treat them as refugees and bring them to this country where they could sort of act as ambassadors for their species.
I think also, you know, the trouble is that if the money weren't spent on zoos, it wouldn't be spent on conservation in Africa. That money would not be directly funneled to Africa. What zoos can do and what the good zoos do is they act as a sort of pressure group, an example of the world we are losing. And they, by getting people...
Building the constituency of interest that Richard described.
Exactly. And by getting people to identify with animals. I mean, I wonder now, after little Joe's escape from the Franklin Park Zoo...
The gorilla who escaped.
Yes. How many more people are now more concerned about gorillas and gorilla welfare? This is the important thing that zoos, I think, can do. Zoos can be ambassadors of the wild. And one of the things that I'm, for instance, they did at Franklin Park Zoo this summer, they had a whole series on the great ape and the plight of the great apes, bringing in people like Richard and Cheryl Knott on orangs and Dale Peterson about the bushmeat crisis and Michelle Goldsmith talking about gorillas. They brought them in to actually highlight the plight of the animals in the wild, and by saying, look, we have these animals here in captivity, and this is what we owe to them in the wild. And that, I think, is one of the crucial developments that has taken place in zoos over the last few years, is increasing recognition on the part of the AZA and the good zoos that they must preserve the wild, and probably their highest task is to actively raise money often for schemes in the wild.
I think it's true that most of the field projects now have some sort of connection with zoos that give them a small amount of funding and see this relationship being very active indeed between conservation and the zoos in this country.
Richard, let me ask you, would you do the work that you do if, as some small child, lo, these many years ago, you hadn't gone and seen the chimpanzees in a zoo?
Well, I don't think zoos were directly influential for me in that way. And, you know, I always worry slightly about the notion that people are going to depend on having that special interspecies recognition moment at a zoo, which, you know, can capture tremendous imagination for a lifetime. But I worry about the principle of that, because think about whales. You know, there's a tremendous amount of interest in whales, and there are many people who have never seen one. We can do a lot through movies. I keep coming back to the notion that a tremendously important function of the zoos is to work in concert with conservation to look after the animals that are being left homeless by the destruction of the forest.
Richard, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Richard Rangan, professor of anthropology at Harvard University, is working on a book about the evolutionary ecology of humans and chimpanzees, due out in just a few months from now. Michael, I haven't heard from you, but when Richard speaks about that responsibility that zoos have, are you in Washington there nodding your head?
Absolutely. In fact, I might mention that zoological parks and aquariums and the AZA were very instrumental in developing something called the Bushmeat Crisis Task Force, which is a consortium of some 35 different organizations working on conservation issues in Africa and attempting to try to work cooperatively to curb the illegal commercial trade in wildlife for meat across the African continent, which is the most significant threat to wildlife in Africa today. Millions of tons are being taken, and this includes representatives of the great apes, including chimpanzees, bonobos, and gorillas, are being taken for human consumption. And we're working very diligently to try to do something about this. And this also includes utilizing AZA member institutions as an educational vehicle to get this message across to the American public, who really is very unfamiliar with this particular crisis.
All right, back to the phones to Greensboro, North Carolina, and Kamal's joining us. Hi, Kamal.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm original from Kenya, and I would like to make a comment about what I hear. The person who was talking earlier said, like, the zoo, they are well fundamental for conservation. But when I look at when I visit the zoological zoo, like the one in North Carolina, down in Nashville, what I see is just animals which are, you know, very desperate-looking lions and underfed, and, you know, they look really out of place. And, well, as much as I would like to appreciate that we need some zoo or for conservation, I also feel like that's a way to deprive, you know, the host, I mean, where this country, I mean, this animal come from, like Kenya. When you bring animals here, don't you think, like, we're depriving our economy, I mean, Kenyan economy, money which can be net from tourists visiting Kenya?
Michael, and, this is one for you. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to respond to that because, in fact, many zoos and aquariums have travel programs, and we understand the importance of animals as an economic source, particularly in developing countries. The wildlife of Kenya is incredibly important to its people and their ability to, you know, retain a stable economy. And we understand that. And by stimulating people to travel to places like Kenya and see animals in nature, zoos and aquariums can also play a very important role. And also, I think it's important to mention that most animals, particularly mammals, well over 90% of the mammals that you see in zoos today have been bred in captivity. They were not brought in from the wild. We take great pains to try to sustain our animal populations and to minimize the number of animals that are ever taken from the wild. And this is very difficult now, too, because you have to have a justification, you have to obtain permits, both from the exporting country and from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here. And this is a very difficult process. It's not an easy thing to do.
But I know, Rory, exactly what Kamal is speaking about when he talks about walking down the row of cages and just feeling awful about seeing the circumstances that the animals are living in. That's the big puzzle that zoos have to deal with, no?
Well, I think this is why it's so good that there is a professional body, the AZA, with an accreditation process. Because I personally would like to see zoos that weren't accredited or had no hopes of being accredited now shut down.
And can they be? Isn't they, I mean, can't you?
I suspect Mike would know more about this, but I suspect, you know, there are several different players in here. There's the USDA, there are the
Department
states.
Department of Agriculture.
Yes,
right.
There's... I mean, you know the variability that there is about keeping dangerous exotic animals from
sure.
state to state. You know, the lady with the 30 tigers in New Jersey, the chap in the apartment in the Bronx. There is a great variability of rules. I mean, I as a child, I mean, one of the most miserable things that ever happened to me was a man came to talk at my school about animals, and he ran a small private zoo. And so I thought, goody, I'll go and stay with him for my school holidays. It was the most miserable experience. You know, he'd converted his father-in-law's house and backyard into a zoo. And, you know, there was this poor solitary chimpanzee in a wire cage in what had been the bay-fronted living room. Now, those sort of things should definitely be shut down. On the other hand, if you look at some of the large, you know, historic zoos, you know, like every institution, as Mike was saying earlier, they can get complacent and they can get out of date. But with an accreditation process, they can be forced into renewal. I mean, to give you one anecdote, the Paris Zoo, the Jardin des Plantes, the first sort of public zoo. When I was young and used to go to it, it had camels and elephants and giraffes in a great stone building built by Napoleon. And you can imagine this was a totally inappropriate building for these animals with, you know, small paved yards and great concrete.
They've converted that to condominiums for people.
Well, they've converted it to now, and this is a very amusing thing, when I took my wife to see it, they've converted it into a micro zoo. Every bay that once housed a giant mammal now houses a microscope assemblage which enables you to look at things like dust mites. After seeing that, my wife came home, and now we turn our mattress every week.
1-800-423-8255 to Cary, North Carolina now, and Perry's joining us. Hi, Perry.
Hi, Dick. Interesting program, as always.
Thanks. Go ahead.
I guess I would just like to comment on my experience at the fine public zoos that I've had the opportunity to visit, including the one in Asheboro, North Carolina. I think the positives for zoos, for me, outweigh the negatives that I've been hearing discussed on the program. And I think one of the biggest pluses for me for zoos is, as one person on the show said, their ambassador from the wild function that they perform, especially for children. I think, you know, when children are young and they go to a zoo and they see animals live and in person, it creates a strong impression on them. They really enjoy the experience, and I think it carries over throughout their whole life and helps to...
Let me ask you a question, though, Perry. If you were to take that child to the IMAX and have that child watch a polar bear frolicking underneath the ice and doing whatever it is that polar bears do up in Hudson Bay, as opposed to looking at them in a white-painted concrete pit that I described earlier. I'm deliberately, you know, giving you the best and the worst for the sake of this question. I'm not trying to say that all polar bears live in situations like that, but what's gained by actually seeing the bear?
I think actually in the scenario you posed, both of those things are valid because the IMAX is actually going to show them in their natural habitat, which you're not going to get a good of a glimpse at in the zoo, but there's something about seeing an animal live, moving around in front of you, you know, unscripted, that you can't replace by looking at it on a screen. We've gone to the zoo. We usually go to the zoo twice a year out here, and every time there's something interesting to see that we always have a good time.
Rory, there's something about seeing that animal live in front of you.
I think there really is. I mean, I would actually add not just seeing, but smelling and hearing it. And I think the unpredictability of the animal, not knowing how the animal will react, what it'll do, as the caller says, every time he goes to the zoo, there is something different. You know, also, a lot of these animals actually interact with people. It's probably something that Mike wouldn't entirely approve of, but it's magical...
Is this the tapping on the glass type reaction?
Yes, I mean, I took my class to the Bronx Zoo just recently to show them the new state-of-the-art Congo exhibit and the tiger exhibit before it had been opened.
These weren't kids holding a rope so they would stay together. You're talking about university students.
Yes,
right?
I'm talking about university students. But, you know, what won over one young woman was the fact that one of the gorillas waved at her. Now, of course, that was probably a gorilla that had been hand-raised, and so it was more and more attuned and more into human beings. Just as there's a gorilla in the Franklin Park Zoo that always sits up against the glass panel, and I've seen it kiss little girls that I brought to the zoo through the glass. Those moments that, as I say, I think probably might cause Mike to cringe in a way, because it's not a gorilla behaving like a gorilla. But on the other hand, it is a moment you can't replace. If I can say something about Richard's point about the whale, mm-hmm. I think the whale is in a rather exceptional I think, category, because I think the whale, I mean, we have to remember that there has been about almost 50 years, I mean, since the Second World War, of great publicity about the plight of the great whales, about the threat of their extinction, and also about the bloody ways in which they were massacred and then torn to pieces by whalers. There's been that, and then there have been sort of consistent television programs. One thinks of Jacques Cousteau and people mm-hmm. like that. Whales, and then, of course, also the recordings, which, as I say, add this extra dimension of sound as well as sight. So I think there's been a campaign. I mean, I wonder how many people watch wildlife documentaries as opposed to how many people go to zoos. Because, of course, people go to zoos as family events and outings. And that's one plug I would make for the zoo. The zoo is a truly democratic, with a small d, institution. And that's why I think American cities in the, you know, the last quarter and of the 19th and first quarter of the 20th century were into the business of founding zoos. They saw zoos as part of making themselves cities, but also sort of healthful recreation for the working class, who were jam-packed in these unhealthy cities and needed to get out to the parks and needed to have healthy, respectable educational entertainment.
Quick question to you, Michael, because we have to go to a break in a moment, but is it okay to have the animals interacting with the people, or are you cringing there?
Well, it depends on the type of interactions that they have, certainly, and you don't want the interactions to be stressful or harmful in any way to the animals, but certainly people can be heavily affected by these kinds of interactions, and that's very important. I think one of the things that zoos provide is real versus virtual experiences with animals, and I grew up in rural Iowa, and my dad and I used to go out and, you know, collect small reptiles and insects and amphibians and study them. And most children don't have an opportunity to do that today growing up in urban environments. And I just think it's really important to learn things through real experience as opposed to, say, television or computers.
Connection listeners, you can't smell the bear cage on a television screen. Does that make a big difference? What's the place of the zoo in society today? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me in the studio, Rory Brown, zoo historian at Harvard University. Michael Hutchins is with us in a studio in Washington. He's director of conservation and science for the AZA. And Michael, I understand, I want to swing this around to what to do when zoos go bad, because the question's come up a couple of times. You know, what do you do? You've actually had this sort of experience yourself with a gorilla that was being treated particularly badly in a zoo that you were looking at, right?
Well, AZA has been a lot more proactive in attempting to protect animals that are outside, you know, their accredited zoos and aquariums. And we did have a situation in a southern non-accredited zoo where a gorilla had been kept in a 10 by 30 cage for many, many years by itself. And our programs and members were very concerned about this and made many attempts to bring that animal into our species survival program so that it could live in a larger, more naturalistic exhibit with other gorillas.
But you couldn't take it away from the person who, and I put this in quotes, owned it.
No, and in fact, you know, ownership is of animals is still something that is, you know, legal in our country. And in this case, the animal, I believe, was a pre-Endangered Species Act, pre-CITES animal. It had come in before those pieces of legislation had been passed. Mm-hmm. And it is therefore impossible. All you can do is, you know, appeal to people's consciousness and appeal to the public to put pressure to do something about it. In this case, we were unsuccessful, but we tried very, very hard. We had a press conference in the Miami area that was, certainly picked up by all of the different stations, but it was still to no avail.
So how do you close down a bad zoo? Does that have to come from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or is this something that needs streamlining, needs work?
Well, AZA considered this quite a bit when it had a what was called a roadside zoo task force. It looked at the most efficient ways to try to start dealing with these kinds of issues. And what we did was actually work with others to develop some model state legislation. Federal legislation is very hard to change, and the Animal Welfare Act is very minimum in its requirements with regard to animal care. But it would be very difficult to change that legislation. On the other hand, state legislation and states are looking at these kinds of issues like private ownership of exotic animals and non-accredited, what might be called substandard institutions, and trying to decide what to do about them. And AZA helped by developing some model state legislation and is trying to get it out through its members to state legislatures and assisting state legislatures in trying to strengthen the laws.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Next to Zebulon, North Carolina, and Ben's joining us. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for calling.
I'd just like to make the point that, well, I mean, first of all, I should say I'm a fairly young guy. I'm 20 years old, and just looking at the state of things now, I think zoos are a vital institution for teaching, you know, children and, you know, people of all ages about what we're losing in the environment. I think one of the commentators made a point earlier saying that, you know, they're sort of the ambassador to the wild. And, you know, seeing animals up close and in real life is, you know, far better than, you know, seeing them on a TV screen or something. It's definitely not the same thing. And
is that your own experience, Ben, that you know, a visit to the zoo when you were younger was kind of instrumental in getting you tuned into what was important about animal care?
Well, yeah, I did travel some to the zoo in Asheboro when I was younger, and also I've traveled a little bit in South America and in school, and I've seen, you know, some zoos down there or just like some national parks that they have down like in Argentina, and they have, you know, pretty good preservation of the wildlife down there. But if, for example, in areas like India where you have, you know, tigers being put in danger, and it's just, I think in about, you know, 10 or 20 years, I mean, we're going to see like major problems. The problems that we have now are just going to be bigger, and zoos are a vital part of keeping people aware of the, you know, endangered species and sort of preserving that link to the wild and protecting those species.
It's a good point that you raise, Ben, and I'll turn to Rory with that here in the studio, that if we look ahead at what the zoos will be for children and grandchildren, will they be, in many cases, the only places where people can go to see a tiger because it's protected from poachers or it's protected from the encroachment of farmers and people in its natural habitat?
Well, of course, one of the things we haven't had time to do today in this our limited discussion is talk about zoos in the third world. And what we have to realize is that, of course, many people in the third world, in the developing world, don't see the animals that we associate with their country. I mean, very often going to the national parks is a rich person's prerogative. And local people very often don't see the need to preserve animals because they get nothing from them. I'm thinking of your earlier caller. They derive no good from them, and they also have no association with them. So I think that's one very important function. I'd also like to talk about the educational programs generally, because zoos, like Zoo New England, not only have, you know, lectures and tours of the zoo on the spot, but they actually also go out in the local communities. In some cases, they run programs at local schools, or in the case of Zoo New England, they bring in children from the Alston Brighton and the Dorchester Roxbury schools into the zoos, and they run the sort of fourth and fifth grade part of the science curriculum. So zoos have a lot of outreach that they do. Now, as to whether we will only end up by seeing endangered species in zoos. Well, there is, as Mike talked earlier, about this complete separation of our species now from the natural world. If you think about how many people now in America still work upon the land, if you think about how little is taught about the living world in schools and universities, if you also think about the unfamiliarity even with domestic animals. I mean, it was already in the 1920s that Mayor Curley thought they should have Guernsey cows in the Franklin Park Zoo because city children thought milk came from bottles. I mean, we have a tremendous debt of ignorance where natural history and the animal and plant worlds are concerned. And one of the things I think zoos are going to have to tackle is getting people to appreciate local wildlife and how to live with local wildlife. Zoo New England sponsors a coyote researcher who is working on coyotes and the spread of coyotes in the absence of wolves into New England and into urban New England. But also we need to teach people about how to live with bears. As suburbia extends into the wild, we need to help people mediate the inevitable conflicts. People like animals, but do they want to live with them?
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Providence, Rhode Island. Glenn's with us now. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I don't understand, seriously, I mean, an outreach zoo project, when they go into the neighborhood to teach about endangered species, I do not understand why we actually have to physically have the animal. I mean, I just don't understand. I don't see why the animal has to be part of that education process.
Give me an example, like a panda bear, for example. You don't the panda to...
Yeah, why do we need a gorilla to prove to people that, you know, the gorillas are endangered? I mean, why is this one particular animal, you know, subject in his life to this horrible process where, you know, he could, you know, be in the wild and live his life? I don't understand why it's important to the human species to, you know, impose their values on the values of the lives of these other animals.
Michael Hutchins, have you got an answer for Glenn on this one?
Well, these are very difficult questions from a philosophical basis. But, you know, I've traveled around the world and I've seen what kind of situation wildlife is in. And I think a lot of us, we think about the wild, quote unquote, as being a sort of a Garden of Eden where animals live their lives, you know, with you know, in a pretty good situation. But, but really that's not the case, not anymore because of the activities of humans. And, you know, some national parks in Africa are fenced 360 degrees. They're literally
islands. Is that keeping the animals in or keeping the
people
out?
Well, it's both. And they're literally islands of habitat in a sea of humanity. That's the best way I could describe it. And they have to be managed, the animal populations inside, much the way that we manage animals in zoos. And I think the message is that we are going to have to manage wildlife for all the reasons that Rory was mentioning earlier, but other reasons as well. The context in which we live today, we live in a human-dominated world, and it's going to be very, very difficult to preserve wildlife. And I certainly understand what the caller was saying, but I also understand the ethical context in which we have to work today, and I still think that zoos and aquariums are going to be incredibly important for the future of wildlife if we can move in the right directions.
Right.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I learned this summer hearing Richard Wrangham and Michelle Goldsmith talk respectively about chimpanzees and gorillas in the wild is how often these animals are ranging out into the farmlands as the farmlands occupy what used to be the sort of buffer zone between the parks and human habitation and cultivation. The farmlands have extended because there's great population pressure and the animals are wandering out and inevitably they come into conflict with humans and are either kill or getting killed. Human diseases of domestic livestock are spreading with sort of epidemic proportions in parts of Africa and affecting, say, lions and wild dogs are affected with domestic distempers and things.
But
the wild is not an Eden. And
the wild is not a wild anymore. I mean, that's the sort of profoundly depressing thing about it. I remember working as a reporter on the northwest coast of Canada when the logging companies were saying, well, we'll cut this valley and this valley and this valley, and we'll leave this one for the bears, and then we'll move north and cut this valley and this valley and this valley. So if you want to know where the grizzly bears are, you know, they're not all over the place. They're just in that one place.
That's why the concept of island, you know, and corridors. I mean, because, of course, you get these minute populations, which are often unable to sustain themselves and are subject to genetic inbreeding. So, you know, a lot of conservation schemes now consists of how to create wildlife corridors between one bit of the managed wild and another bit of the managed wild. So unfortunately, there isn't an Eden out there, as you said. The other thing to, of course, remember is that the gentleman is talking about this important philosophical issue about animals' captivity. Many of these animals have not known anything except captivity. They have been born in the zoo. They've been brought up in the zoo. They wouldn't survive in the wild. As Mike Hutchins says, we're not allowed to import many, many species anymore, either by the country of origin or by, indeed, international and U.S. law. So animals, I mean, part of the reason that zoos got into conservation was self-interest. After World War II, when many of the third world countries became independent, the colonial authorities had already rationed the number of animals that could come out, but many countries put a complete ban because they did see these animals as being part of their heritage. And so animals, you know, there are places like the San Diego Wild Animal Park, which is now a wonderful, wonderful, huge zoo with great territories for the animals, was founded originally as a sort of breeding, a backcountry breeding facility.
So, Michael, conservation, preservation, these are the watchwords for zoos in the future.
Well, I think they've got to be, and this is because the context in which we live, you know, the times do determine what institutions must become, and I think that conservation must be our highest priority. And at the same time, in order to fulfill those missions of conservation and the associated educational and scientific work that zoos do, we have to take excellent care of the animals. We cannot teach people about animals unless the psychological and physiological welfare of animals is maintained at a very high level.
Well, Glenn, there is an answer to your question. It may not be what you wanted to hear, but it's an informed answer. I thank you for your call. And Michael Hutchins, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you very much.
Michael's Director of Conservation and Science for the American Zoo and Aquarium Association, and Rory Brown. Nice to have you with us on the program.
Thanks very much, Dick. It's nice to see you.
Rory is zoo historian and serves at Harvard University and serves on the Advisory Council for Zoo New England. Earlier in the program, we talked with Richard Rang, a professor of anthropology at Harvard University. He's studying chimpanzees at Kibale National Park in Uganda. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Someone told me it's all happening at the zoo. I do believe it. I do believe it's true. It's a light and tumble journey from the east side to the park, just a fine and fancy ramble to the zoo. But you can take a cross-town bus if it's raining or it's cold, and the animals will love it if you do.